Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears off and running with you here Tuesday, January 26th. 2021, 13 and a half minutes past the hour. Can you believe the last Tuesday in January today? Unbelievable how time flies. Now, we have got a great program over the next 2 hours for you. I'm going to tell you really quickly what's coming up in hour number two. We are going to have our monthly chat with the mayor of the city of Marion, Scott Schertzer. He will be along in hour number two. And then we have a special guest in the last 15 minutes of hour number two this morning that I'm not going to tell you about, but this person has been on this program before. You're not going to want to miss them. And today they are on for two reasons. Number one, the inauguration of President Biden. And number two, new veteran broadcaster Larry King, somewhat well, worked with him in the last year of his life. So we will get some remembrances of the legendary Larry King in hour number two. Now, much of what I just said could be said for our guest in hour number one. She has been a friend of this program for about 5 years now. She always gives her expert analysis of everything going on. And in this sad time of the passing of veteran broadcaster Larry King, she appeared in one of the last shows Larry did 5 months ago on his Politicking show on RT. She is a reporter for the Daily Beast, columnist, long-running panelist on the television series The McLaughlin Group. She is Eleanor Cliff. Before we get to Eleanor, though, Larry King appeared on this program twice, and his last appearance was in July 3rd, 2012. Larry King was on this show, and I asked him at that time, he had just left CNN after 27 years, and Larry and I talked about it. So here's this 2.5 minute clip of the legendary late Larry King on this program.
The last time we talked was in December. This is a little diversion from Andy Griffith. But we talked in December, and I asked you about leaving CNN. And you said that you were hurt at that time that they didn't offer you a 3-year contract when they offered you the one, which is what brought the end of Larry King Live. In February, they dropped the specials. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I think I think, as I've been told by some people there, that they just felt that, you know, when I came, the last special was Dinner with the Kings, and it did so well. It was a tremendous ratings thing. And so people are calling in, where is he, or why don't you bring him back? And I think it was kind of embarrassing for them. And I was kind of a guy who came into your home every night, and they knew I was going to go on to other things, and now I'm starting in July, this one, now, starting in a couple weeks. Aura TV, we're going to be on the internet, we're going to be distributed by Hulu. Someone told me we'll be seen by more people in a month than saw me in a year. It's hard to believe, and I've been setting up tapes, and we're set to launch July 16th.
You were hurt when they gave you the 1 year. How did this make you feel when you got the news? 27 years with that company.
Well, you know, it's never easy, you know. I mean, I could have taken an extra one. I had 1 year coming, so I did that 1 year. And they were fine with me. You know, Colin Powell said it best to me. When the train gets to the last stop, you get off. And nothing is forever. I never owned the camera. I was an employee of Time Warner. They were very good to me. I was very good for them. It wasn't a divorce per se. It was a long, happy marriage that things come to an end. You know, you're born and you die, and nothing is forever. I miss it, especially on days when there are big stories. But I've been doing speaking. I've been all over the world. I just came back from Azerbaijan. I've been in Lisbon. I've been in Seoul. I've been speaking at conferences. I've been in Moscow. I've been in Kazakhstan. I watch my kids play ball. I got one son in baseball camp in Florida, another in football camp in Utah. I lead a full life.
Well, Larry, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and you may not have owned the camera on CNN, but a lot of people felt like you did for 25 years.
Thank you so much, Scott. Really great talking to you.
Always great. Larry King, the legend.
Thank you, babe.
The legendary Larry King on this program, July 3rd, 2012, passed away Saturday at the age of 87. Joe, we turn to our guest now who knew Larry. Eleanor, nobody like Larry King for sure.
No, he really did define the art of the talk show for a long time. And, you know, it's interesting because journalists kind of made fun of him because he bragged about not preparing. If he had an author on, he wouldn't read the book. And he basically just kind of leaned forward in that with his suspenders and made people feel comfortable. And it was his show where all the celebrities went when they needed to repair their image after a scandal, and politicians too. And he got them to open up, and so that was his gift. I only came to realize that in recent years when I would occasionally do whatever show he had. He always had something going. I mean, he never stopped working, and you know, he drew life and sustenance from being in front of a microphone or a TV camera or a radio outlet. I mean, that defined his life, and you know, he had a very rich, full life, full of you know, victories, which he talked to you about, and full and with tragedy. He lost two adult children just this last year, multiple divorces, serious health challenges, and yet, you know, he was always there. He was always there the next day, the next morning, with the curiosity and a zest for life. So you got to admire that, and I think that's people really did look to him, as he put it, to come into their house. And CNN did not treat him well, and yet over this last weekend, my goodness, they treated him like a reigning star for much of Saturday and into Sunday, and specials and all of that. So I'm sure he would have enjoyed it. And he's getting the last word, let's put it that way.
Absolutely. Eleanor, where does he go? Because you brought it up there. For a long time, the word was Larry King's a patsy. He's not going to ask a hard question. That's why presidents and politicians will go on with him. Where does he go in broadcast history when it's written?
Oh, I think his name says it all, and it was not his given name. He had a Ziegler or something like that. He had a very different name. By adopting the name Larry King, I think he's one of the giants of broadcast journalism, and I think that understanding that he got people to tell their stories, I think that's more appreciated today than it was then. It didn't seem that unusual when he was at the top of talk radio or at CNN, as we had our Cronkites, and we had other people who, you know, occupied the full spectrum, who they weren't a darling of the left or the right, or all people could relate to him. And I think it's his era of talk preceded the extreme bifurcation of the media into left wing and right wing celebrities. And so I think he's an important figure.
Absolutely. And for those who don't remember, when he did leave CNN, he did not stop. In 2012, he went over to Aura TV, did a show called Larry King Now, then ended up on RT with a show called Politicking, which ran right up until before the election, until he went into the hospital diagnosed with COVID-19. And Eleanor, you were one, had to be one of his last guests. You were on right before the election 5 months ago. Was it any different? I mean, he definitely had health problems. He had a stroke. He couldn't walk anymore at that point. But he was still doing these shows. He was still cranking them out. What was it like the last time you were on with him?
Well, it was virtual. So I was sitting in a studio here in Washington, and he's in Los Angeles. And so I don't see him fully. I see his face. He chats for, maybe 15 seconds before you go live, and, you know, always ask me how things are going. And of course, you know, he knew John McLaughlin, and so, you know, I've chatted with him over the years here and there. And then you're on, and then it's over. And I think I got some queries from his producer in recent months, and then suddenly they were canceled. And so I think he had a stroke earlier this year. I'm not even sure what his health issues were. I mean, when he spoke, there was never any difference between the old Larry and the new Larry. And my most memorable time, I didn't do his live show very often, a handful of times. One time I remember was when Joe Klein, who was then a columnist at Newsweek, had written a very well-received novel, which was a parody of the Clintons, but he didn't put his name on it. It was written by Anonymous. And he was asked if he was the author, and he denied it. And the then editor of Newsweek, Maynard Parker, who knew that Klein had written the book, also lied and said no, he wasn't the author. And so then it was exposed, and it was a big scandal for that time that he would have lied about this, and that the editor of this prestigious publication, Newsweek, would have, you know, helped him do this. And I was called to go on Larry King's show to talk about it. And, you know, I was tempted to say, no, I don't want to get in the middle of this thicket. I didn't want to betray a colleague. I didn't want to defend lying. I didn't know where I stood. And yet I felt like it would have been chicken not to bail out. So I did the show. I have no idea how I got through it. It was a balancing act. But when you're sitting in the studio, as it was then, across from Larry King, the fact that he makes everybody feel comfortable is the defining feature. And he doesn't ask long, complicated questions. I don't remember what he specifically said, but it was probably something like, so what do you think of your colleague doing this? Or, you know, something like that, you know, 10-word questions that they don't, not quite a yes or a no, but they do, they do require an answer.
You know, Eleanor, he was on for 25 years on CNN. I think he called that the best years of his life. And when we look at that 25-year period, I would say early 90s through maybe 2005, 2006, the importance of going on Larry King for people who did not live during that time kind of explained that. It was a huge deal.
It was big, exactly. If you're invited on Larry King, well, and there were other shows, like Nightline would have been in that category, or Good Morning America, and it probably still is, he was top of the charts. That's right.
And just one more question on this, and just because of the times we live in, and not to make an assumption on what ended Larry's life on Saturday morning, he was 87, he did have a lot of health problems, but we did find out in late December that he had been tested positive for COVID-19. He was in intensive care in Cedars-Sinai, and last week I think we learned that he had been moved out of intensive care into a room, but you know, this pandemic does not discriminate against anybody, and I think it was said that they think he contracted it from a healthcare worker. It's a tough, tough illness.
No, I know. I don't know whether he probably did not receive the vaccine. And who knows, what the details are, but the vaccine is... I'm grateful. I've managed to get the shot here in the District of Columbia, and then you pick up the paper and it says the new variants out there. The drug manufacturers are now scrambling to find out if the vaccine is effective against the new variants. So you know, you feel like during this whole year, every time you feel like you're getting a little bit of a handle on what's happening and you're feeling maybe a little bit of control, is the headline that comes along to just shake up, shake whatever confidence you might have managed to achieve. But, you know, we are in a new day. I do think the administration is going to do everything they can to ramp up production and get this vaccine out to everyone. I mean, it's ridiculous the lengths to which people are going through to try to get these appointments online. My son and his wife, to get me an appointment, set up what they called a war room with four computers going, a couple of phone lines, and the site in the district crashed a couple of times. And my son said it was like hunting down Bin Laden to try to get an appointment. And not everybody has a, you know, family member that's so adept at the internet that they can pull it off. A lot of people out there have no idea how to go about this. So, I mean, I think we're going to get this in place, and by summer we should be feeling a lot better. But no, it's been a real challenge.
Having taken the vaccination, with all the information we know, like the new variants, what confidence do you have now to go out in public? Is it better? Less?
Oh, well, first of all, I've only gotten the first shot. Okay. Then you need, 4 weeks later, you get the second shot, and they're saying that a modicum of immunity does not kick in until 10 days after the booster shot. So, no, I'm not changing anything.
Do you think, and that's an interesting point, do you think the majority of people getting this inoculation understand what you just said?
No. And, you know, David Leonhardt, who is with the New York Times, he's a very highly regarded writer, reporter, he wrote a blog recently about, he must live in Virginia or Maryland, because the district opened up the appointments to everyone over 65, and also people with all kinds of health conditions. It's much more accessible here in the district. But he described his 74-year-old mother couldn't get an appointment, and so she had lived in Colorado, and she was eligible in Colorado. So he drove her halfway to Colorado, where his sister picked her up, and so she went to Colorado to get the vaccine. That's pretty daring. But then he chronicled his road trip and was shocked at how little awareness there seemed to be throughout the country where he stopped. People weren't wearing masks. People were closely gathered together. And he realized that here in the Washington, Virginia, what we call the DMV area, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, people are pretty respectful about the mask wearing, and there's the restaurants really aren't open and all that. That's not true in a lot of parts of the country. Many parts of the country where, you know, people are kind of openly defying wearing masks, and they seem to think that now that the vaccine is here, even if they haven't gotten the dose, that the worst of the problem is over. So it's a mixed bag. I think it does cry out for national leadership, and we're getting that now finally.
Want to talk about the Biden presidency. Let's start with the executive orders. Now, there were a lot of these signed last week. And for people who do not understand what's going on, what are the important things to know about what was done last week with the executive orders?
Well, the first day was pretty much devoted to getting more awareness of COVID. I mean, I think he signed a executive order or invoked the Defense Production Act, because the problem with the vaccine is not demand. The demand is there, the supply is not there. He put in He signed an executive order for a mask mandate on federal lands and federal property. So if you go into federal buildings here, and of course, again, in the District of Columbia, you can't go into a Starbucks without wearing a mask. So, I mean, that's kind of a done deal. But he put it in place for interstate travel and airlines and whatever. So it's to set an example, I think. He rejoined through executive order, I think, a lot of these things don't require executive order. He rejoined the World Health Organization. He rejoined the Paris Climate Treaty. So these are all signals that there's a new day when it comes to regarding health protocols. I give the former president a lot of credit for, you know, getting Operation Warp Speed up and running and really, you know, lighting the fire under the drug makers to produce a vaccine fast. But he really abdicated his job for much of this past year in terms of not wanting to recognize how lethal this virus is, and the fact that mask wearing really can make a difference, and he refused, for a lot of reasons, he refused to do that. And I think we see, you know, every day Biden taking various actions, and he's lifted the ban on transgender troops serving. He's undoing a lot of things that the former president put in place. He lifted the Muslim ban, the ban on Muslims coming into the country. He stopped construction on the wall. I think he increased the allotment of food stamps. So just a lot of steps that he can do with the stroke of a pen or simply by uttering an order. But the hard part is going to be legislation, and he's got a pandemic relief bill and a economic relief bill for $1.9 billion. I'm not sure if the COVID is part of the overall bill or it's a separate bill, but that's going to be a test. If the Congress can react at least on a somewhat timely basis, they don't do anything fast, but they can't dither for months. Biden has, you know, really weeks to deliver on his first promise to get the pandemic under control, and he needs Congress's help to do that because the states need the money to set up the testing sites and get everything in place. And he's promised to open the schools in April, and that requires getting teachers vaccinated, getting schools retrofitted so that there's more aeration, getting testing supplies. So there's a lot that that requires congressional action in terms of delivering money to be able to respond to the virus. Things that we should have done, frankly, 8 months ago. But better late than never.
Want to come to that bill in just a second, but before we do, one of the big stories in the last few days, and it's kind of murky for a lot of people, is the Keystone Pipeline and a loss of a lot of jobs. What exactly happened there, and what are the facts behind it?
Well, the Obama administration was opposed to the Keystone Pipeline, and it's the form of drilling that goes into the tar sands. It's the most, it's the dirtiest oil. We don't really need oil now. I have a cat water drink thing that is making a lot of noise because it needs water. I need to put water in it. Hold on.
Oh, sure. Go right ahead. We're chatting with Eleanor Clift here on WWGH Radio. Of course, Eleanor is a long-running panelist on the hit television series, The McLaughlin Group. She's been there for many, many years. You can still catch that on PBS affiliates, and it is available online. Just search McLaughlin Group on YouTube or many other sites. She also is a columnist for The Daily Beast, dailybeast.com. Search Eleanor Clift, and you can find all of
her articles.
Sorry about
that.
No problem.
it's plugged into the wall and the water runs in, and when it gets below a certain level, it makes this horrible sound and threatens to get to dry out and I guess go on fire. Who knows? Anyway, I just added some water. Okay. All right. We were talking about the
pipeline,
the Keystone Pipeline. Yeah. So environmentalists are opposed. We don't really need the oil. The Obama administration was against it, and it became one of those litmus tests between right and left, and as soon as Trump took office, he started it up again. It does provide jobs. I don't know how many, but they're temporary jobs. These are not jobs that are going to continue forever. So, I don't know if there's a way for the government, the federal government, to somehow, you know, make amends or get at least unemployment insurance to the people who will lose their jobs. But, you know, environmentally, we don't need the oil, and we certainly don't need oil that is extracted in that fashion.
Now, I want to turn to this bill, because this bill has been talked about. It hasn't even been a week yet, but there's a lot of stuff in here for every person in this country that will affect every person in this country. Now, I'm just going to do an overview, and then we'll come back and pick some of these things up. $1,400 for every additional citizen making under a certain amount of money, and that includes dependents, which we did not think it was going to at one point, even elderly parents who might be living with you, another $1,400 for each of them. $15 minimum wage, people think that might be very difficult to get through. $10,000 in student debt being forgiven, at least $10,000. Some say all student debt being forgiven. That was a big promise of President Biden.
He never promised to get rid of all student debt.
But some. Was it 10,000?
Yes, but not all.
Right. Yeah. But some people, like the Bernie Sanders group, they want it all gone. These issues, the $15 minimum wage, the student debt, the $1,400 to everybody, including dependents who make under a certain amount of money, is that going to happen? Likely? Not likely?
Well, $1,400 would be added to the $600 that was voted on for the election to make the $2,000 that I believe President Trump was supporting, and that polls show a pretty strong majority of Americans think is suitable. The criticism there, which I share, is that you could probably target the money better. It would be better to extend unemployment benefits, which run out in mid-March, but that becomes a state function, and state unemployment systems really can't keep up with it. But that would be a better way to get that money to people who are unemployed than to also include people who some people are doing quite well, actually, during the pandemic. So there's some, differences about that. But overall, I think it's a good idea. It's a promise kept. It's a promise made, in fact, by both parties at various points. And it's something that is easy to understand. And I think it has more pros than cons. The $15 minimum wage is definitely needed. We haven't raised the minimum wage since Ted Kennedy was in the Senate. But is it going to be part of this bill? It's something you could take out. They're just beginning the process. And talking process is a very hard sell, I must say. You're going to have a lot of people in different parties arguing this out and debating it out. And as President Biden said in a press conference yesterday, we've had a Senate basically that hasn't had any really good debates. They haven't really done any legislation. They did deliver on COVID relief quickly, massively, and I don't want to take that away from them. But in terms of putting together legislation in what John McCain used to call regular order, where you have committees working on it, and you have hearings, and you have markups. We haven't really seen that for a long while, and I think that's what Biden is pointing out, that he's spent most of his life as a legislator, 30-some-odd years, and he knows how it works. You don't get everything you ask for. you put it in there, and it's a lot of bargaining chips, and there's a lot of negotiation. I think the challenge that he faces is, can he get enough Republican support that he can reach the 60 vote level? And in order to get Republican support, how much does he water down the package? And then does he invite the disappointment on the left of people who say you campaigned on doing big and bold and important things? So they're going to get something, but whether they get it with Republican help or they go with what's called reconciliation, which is a budget maneuver where if the legislation is directly voted, directly related to spending and taxation, you can get through with a party vote of 51, which the Democrats do have those votes. So those are the decisions that will be made in the coming weeks. But you know, you never get everything you ask for in legislation, and neither side is completely happy. But both sides should walk away feeling they got something that's positive, and that's the art of legislative compromise, which you know Biden is a master of. He's not going to directly negotiate, but his top aides have already done some virtual meetings with they call it the Sweet 16 senators, evenly split between Democrats and Republicans, who you know have committed to working together on this.
When it comes to the $10,000 forgiveness of student debt, now President Biden seems very big that this is, I think he said, the first thing he needs to get done, because he did promise this. Is this likely to happen? That's a big deal to a lot of people in this country.
Yeah, it's a big deal, and if the Republicans are reading the polls, you would think they'd want to get in on it too. So I think that's quite possible. But is that going to be at the head of the line before extending eviction notices? No, I think actually he was able to extend eviction notices by executive order. But you know that is one of the moving pieces, and you can argue about you know how much do you forgive and what do you suspend interest, but then is the interest then have to be repaid? That's not much of a gift, I must say. So you know, I do think every president, especially a new president, is really conscious of the promises they made, and I think Biden was careful not to overpromise. I mean, it was Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders who wanted to forgive all student debt, and I believe Biden drew the line there. So it pays off if you don't overpromise, then perhaps you can actually deliver.
When it comes to this, because we now know that Congress is controlled by the Democrats, the Senate slimly is controlled by the Democrats, 50-50, with a deciding vote coming up to Vice President Harris, and Bernie Sanders on one of the Sunday shows said that we do need to take this measure to do the 51 votes and just get it through for the $15 minimum wage, for the $1,400 per family. I don't think he talked directly about the student debt in that interview, but could be in there. Do you think I understand President Biden wants compromise and he wants people to get on board and Republicans and Democrats both to vote on things, but if he can't get the 60, do you think this is likely to happen?
Well, first of all, in order to change the rules, he'd have to have every Democrat plus the vice president to change the rules to get rid of the filibuster. And right now, Senator Manchin of West Virginia, Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, and Senator John Tester of Montana, they are all on the conservative side of the Democratic spectrum, and they're opposed to changing the filibuster. But Senator Tester, in a very revealing interview last week, said he's opposed to eliminating the filibuster, but if Mitch McConnell and the Republicans use it to block everything the Democrats try to do, he said, then I could change my mind. And so I think Biden is going to give the Republicans weeks, not months, to decide whether they really want to cooperate. And he's not going to put up with what President Obama did, which was basically a year of Republicans saying, you know, give us a little more time, we can get these votes. And in the end, in Obama's memoir, he describes how Harry Reid, who was the then Democratic leader, told him that Olympia Snow, who was then the senator, progressive senator from Maine, Republican, Reid told Obama that Olympia Snow would fold like a cheap suit once Mitch McConnell put the screws to her on whether she would be cooperating with Obama. And that's exactly what happened. He describes Snow coming and saying that she couldn't vote with him on Obamacare. And the word was that McConnell had told her that he would strip her of her her chairmanship of the Small Business Administration Committee. So that's how, that's hardball. That's how politics works. And if McConnell wants to play that game, Biden's not going to get trapped by it the way Obama did. And he's got, you know, he's got some tools. One, he can say, okay, you know, forget it on this COVID relief. If he can keep his Democrats together, we'll do it with Democrats only. And then on future legislation like immigration reform and the other big pieces he wants to put out there, he does have that ability to end the filibuster if McConnell is just going to play the obstruction game. So, I mean, I think McConnell is on trial here, and how he's going to perform will basically influence what Biden does. Biden clearly would like to find consensus, but if that becomes impossible, he's not going to wait, you know, months to realize that that's an impossible dream. He will take action because he's got a limited amount of time. He's got to rebuild, you know, trust in government, which is a very tall order, and the only way you do it is to, you know, deliver on for the needs of the American people. And polls show people need economic relief. They want to get past the pandemic. Their hopes and dreams and pocketbooks are being crushed by student debt. I mean, there are some things here that really do need doing, and they can't really wait.
Well, you talked about the conservative Democrats there who possibly might not vote for this. Are there any Republicans who would be in the category of voting for this bill, a bill like this?
Well, you would think Senator Romney, Senator Collins, Senator Murkowski, and then you could add in Senator Porter from Ohio, who said he's not going to run again, Senator Toomey from Pennsylvania, who's on his way out the door. He's not going to run again either. But the early signs were not promising. Romney and Collins both said, gee, we just passed this huge bill right before the election. We're not sure this is really needed. We should wait and see. Though that's not, there's no time to wait and see here. The economy is likely to take another downward dip if help isn't on the way. And I look to Lewis Powell, who is the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Now, he was appointed by Donald Trump. He's as chair of the Federal Reserve. I mean, it's a big job, and it's traditionally not a partisan job. And he's basically saying we need more money put into the economy, it's a disservice if we do too little. It won't have the impact we need. And money right now is so cheap. There's no interest, basically, on money. You could just borrow. Now, the sugar high will come to an end someday, but right now is not the time to pull back on the throttle. I mean, the economy really, really needs the help, and people need the help. And I do think, you know, Biden has said in his press conference yesterday, you know, we're just beginning the process. I want to make my case to everybody and to the Republicans and explain to them why I think we need these various pieces. And so that's how legislation works or used to work. And I think, you know, Biden is hoping that he said that we can have these conversations without the vitriol. So I hope he's right. I think everybody benefits if they can actually argue and debate about policies and come together with a consensus. I think Biden would be willing to take a somewhat smaller bill than he would like if he can get buy-in from Republicans. But he's not going to take, like, you know, half of what he wants, or a skinny this or a skinny that. You know, this is a time to deliver on promises and to go bigger rather than smaller.
We're chatting with Eleanor Clift here, and we've got her for 7 more minutes. And in that 7 minutes, I want to talk about the impeachment trial for President Trump. Now, the article has been delivered to the Senate, the article of impeachment. And at this particular point, according to the New York Times, as of yesterday, no Republicans have said they support it. But 16 say they are undecided, 27 said no, and there was no response from 7. Just for the record, the Democrats, 36 say they support, 9 are undecided, none have said no, and 3, no response. I believe Senator Schumer has said the trial would start sometime in February. What is this impeachment all about? What does it look like? Does it look like there could be a possible conviction this time?
Well, it's a single article, and basically it goes to the president's role in inciting the riot that we saw at the Capitol. And I think in the next 2 weeks, you could see more evidence be compiled about the strenuous efforts he went through to undo the results of the election, and to coordinate with he and his people and his family, possibly coordinating with these groups that turn violent. Possibility of conviction right now, it looks very difficult for 17 Republicans to cross over and if you had all the Democrats voting to convict, that's what it would take. That looks like a very high bar. But if more evidence comes out over the next 2 weeks, I think I don't rule it out completely. And I think the Senate leader, McConnell, has clearly had enough with Donald Trump and would like to figure out a way to turn the page for the Republican Party away from him. But you look at all the polls, he has a strong hold on self-identified Republicans. And so every Republican is mindful of the fact that they could be facing a primary challenge from somebody who is a strong supporter of Donald Trump, and that that Donald Trump has a hold on the hearts and minds of a majority of Republicans. So I think Republican lawmakers don't know quite what to do, and I think many of them are falling back on process arguments, saying, well, it's not really constitutional to hold a trial about removing somebody from power when they've already left office. And so they're kind of settling on that. And the Chief Justice Roberts, who presided over the first impeachment trial, will not be doing it. Instead, the President Pro Tem of the Senate, who's the longest-serving member of the Senate, Patrick Leahy from... he's Patrick Leahy. He's from Vermont, I think. Am I wrong about that?
I think that's right. I'll double check.
That's right.
Here,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's been there forever. So he would preside over the trial, and it would be, I think, 3 or 4 days. And the president has engaged a new attorney, an election law attorney from South Carolina, who's never done anything on this scale. So And President Biden, in a kind of off-the-cuff interview yesterday, said he felt that the impeachment trial had to happen. I mean, it is once the House impeaches, the Senate really has to deal with it, and so it needs to go ahead. But he's, you know, he is concerned. He doesn't. His focus is on getting legislation through, and getting his agenda in place, and getting his cabinet officials confirmed. And I must say, it was a positive sign that it was McConnell who suggested they delay the impeachment trial for 2 or 3 weeks, in order, and that would give time and space for Biden to get his cabinet in place. So that was a sign of cooperation. Each side got something. I mean, that's how this is supposed to work. Each side gets something. They don't get all they want, but they get something. So I choose to be optimistic about how the Senate can go forward. I mean, we have not really had a functioning government for some time, and it's you know, and we need it. The needs in the country are enormous on the health front, on the economic front. The climate issue is becoming more urgent by the passing day, and kind of a racial reckoning also took place over this last year, and you know, people want some answers there. And you know, government is how we take care of the needs of the people, and so they need to perform.
Final topic here today with 2 minutes left to go, Eleanor. There was a lot of talk prior to January 6th about the troubles that President Trump would have with the Southern District of New York when he was no longer president. He's no longer president. He did not pardon himself. He did not pardon any family members that we're aware of. What is going on in the Southern District? Is there anything coming out of there at this point?
No, but they've been getting their ducks in a row for quite some time. And frankly, you know, I believe that the lengths to which Donald Trump went to try to remain in office have a lot to do with how vulnerable he feels once he no longer has the protections of the presidency. He has $400 million, was that, in loans that he's personally attested to that are coming due. He's got the lawsuits in the Southern District of New York, plus from the Attorney General of New York. And there's more is going to be revealed about his relationship with Deutsche Bank and Deutsche Bank's relationship with Russia and the oligarchs. I think he's going to have a very difficult time legally. I think he's, and that's why he, one of the reasons why he wanted to maintain his hold on power, because the Oval Office and the presidency provided some protection from all of those creditors and those lawsuits.
Mm. And just quickly, with 10 seconds to go, how soon, and it's all a guess, how soon do you think we're going to hear something out of the Southern District?
Okay, where do we end? We're at the end of March. I would think by March.
By March. It's going to be interesting. Eleanor, thank you so much for coming on this morning. It's always an education, and we hope everything goes as it's been going, peaceful, and no more trouble in the country that way.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay. Thank you, Eleanor.
All right, thanks, Scott. Bye-bye. All right, bye-bye.
Eleanor Clift, you can't beat that. We're coming back with the mayor and a surprise guest. Stay tuned.
The baloney. The other one said I had a dream too, and mine was a world beater. I also died and went to by St. Peter. He rushed to me, held out his hand, he said,